Brenda Clark of Mount Carlin. I'm a member of the Downtown Lakeland Group, and my sobriety date is October 3rd, 1990. And I would like to thank Charlie for calling me and asking me to come over here. It's a real pleasure to get asked to speak out of town. That's kind of a big deal for an old gal like me. I was never asked to go anywhere with anybody respectable before. I started to drink when I was a little girl, about 13, and I didn't really know what I was doing. I had no idea that it would do what it did for me. I was raised out on the West Coast, my older sister and I. My parents got divorced. They were just kids when they got married, and they split up and left us with a great aunt and uncle. And the great aunt was abusive, and my sister was very abused when we were growing up and was real sick there. And I wasn't. I thought that I was okay as long as I behaved, and I always wondered why she didn't. I always wondered why she didn't just shut up, why she didn't just behave, why she didn't just not fight back. And those were the things I did. I shut up and I behaved and I didn't fight back. And I didn't get my hands dirty and I didn't mess up my little organdy dresses and I didn't get in the way and I kind of skulked around and didn't meet you eye to eye and didn't stand up straight and just didn't make any waves. When I was about 13 years old, I went to visit my father. He lived in another state and he had remarried, had a couple of little kids and a nice, pretty young wife. And I guess he thought that he would make an effort, you know, toward getting acquainted with us. And so he invited a hormonal 13-year-old into his home, and Daddy was a practicing alcoholic. He wasn't home a lot, and his wife didn't know a whole lot about dealing with teenagers. So I got out a lot, and I got in a lot of trouble, and that was when it started. I met the young man that was to be my first husband, and he gave me my first drink. And when that happened, things began to change. Before that, I had stringy hair and freckles and was skinny and just had no ability to interact with anyone. Scared to death of everybody. And I had a couple of drinks. I got real straight. My angles kind of curved out, and my freckles ran together, and I could talk, and I could meet you on your own ground, and I could dance, and I could have a good time, and I liked that. That worked well for me right from the beginning. I did not understand about blackout. Most everything that I know about my aberrant behavior over the next almost 30 years is secondhand information, because I always blacked out. I blacked out from the first drink I ever had. And by the time I was in AA, maybe a couple of years, someone indicated to me that that is not the usual procedure for alcohol. That is the usual procedure for alcoholics. I thought everybody blacked out when they drank. I didn't know. So I went back and forth to the West Coast and to my father's for a couple of years. The aunt passed away, and I married that young man. And that was in the 60s, and we had a lot of things going on then, a lot of exciting things. He was a little older than me, joined the Marine Corps, and he went off to the Bay of Pigs, and when he came back, we were going to take up housekeeping, and I was going to drink. And the Marine Corps doesn't deal well with aberrant behavior, so I couldn't stay around the military base, and he had to stay there, so me and the bottle had to go somewhere else. Went back to the West Coast, and I replaced him with whoever was next, and things were going on out there too, because we had Vietnam and we had a lot of things happening, a lot of activities. We had anti-war and we had political things, and people were drinking and partying and coming and going. So I left Los Angeles and went south to San Diego, because there were ships coming and going. And I had found that people paid attention to me now. I could drink and party a little bit, and I got some attention, and I'd never had that, and I liked it. So that's where I went. I got the next husband there, and he drank like I did then. And he went away, and I drank worse by the time he got back, and so I replaced him with whoever was next. And whoever was next was a Hells Angel. He participated in some things that I had never seen before. he taught me some brand new things, and they worked real well for me, and I liked them. And I do not talk about drugs at AA meetings, but I only allude to this part of my life because of this process. The drinking took a back seat to heroin addiction for a couple of years, and I ended up in treatment out there. And in the 60s, treatment was not what it is today. On the West Coast, in the late 60s, treatment was housed at the California Rehabilitation Center, which was the prison, prison for women. And they had, you know, gun towers and correctional officers and the whole nine yards. There was no playing volleyball for the insurance ran out. It was vastly different. And they counseled with you. You had group therapy 1 hour a day, so they didn't call it prison, they called it treatment. I stayed there 2 years, and when I got out of there, my health angel had gone to prison for a long time. And so that was over with, and I had learned a couple of things while I was in there. I learned to walk around in terror. I had learned to be just deathly afraid and survive that. And I had learned to be a chameleon. I had learned to do whatever it took to stay alive. And I suppose that was just a furthering of what I had learned when I was a little girl. Just fit, no matter what. Just say what they want you to say, be what they want you to be, wear what they tell you to wear, and don't make any waves. And my father took me back into his home with his family at that time. And now he had another child, so he had three little kids. And they really tried to help me. They really did. I was still pretty young, maybe 20. And my behavior was so aberrant because the main thing that I had learned in treatment was that heroin will do two things for you. It will kill you if you use too much, and they will lock you up if they catch you using it. And they don't do that with alcohol. We can drink all we want. And as long as we don't run over people in the road or do any real abusive thing, we can stay pretty drunk till we die. We can just do that. And they don't lock you up for it. So that was the deal. I started getting a bottle real good. Now I'm learning to drink. Now I'm really learning to drink with the big guys. I went to work in bars. I wanted to be where the drinking was. Everything I did was about the drinking. I finally ran through my dad. He just couldn't do me anymore. He was still drinking, and he was still practicing, but he was still working and earning a living and taking care of a family. And, you know, my dad never sobered up. He died a couple of years ago. He never sobered up, but drinking never took him where it took me. He never had to lose everything or abuse everybody the way that I did. They finally couldn't keep me anymore. It was unbearable for his family. And I had to leave there. So I found whoever was next. And he drank like I did. And I liked that. And we went away and did whatever people do and eventually got married and had a daughter and kept drinking together. We drank together for several years and did all the things that people do when they drink together. We wrecked cars together. We beat on each other a little bit. We did those things that if we practice alcoholism a long time, we do to other people and each other. The drinking did not affect him the way that it did me. He drank as much and as hard and as aberrantly as I did, but when he saw that it was destroying his life, he was able to stop it, and I wasn't. And so I had to leave. I just had to take my drinking and go. By now, I have been in some mental institutions, some hospitals, a lot of jails, short-time jail stuff. The worst I ever did in jail was a year. Usually it was like 30 days, maybe a couple of weekends, for the drunk driving, that kind of thing. I got arrested a lot for drunk driving. And back in those days, they didn't view it like they do now. Now they're trying to help people stay alive. Back then, drunk driving was just sort of something that happened to you when you left the bar and they were out there and they had to make a quota or something. And on the West Coast, The first one, they always reduce to reckless driving. And the second one, they slap you on the wrist. And the third one, they give you a big fine. And, you know, jail didn't come into play until in the 70s when I guess it was getting out there. Well, I had done all of those things. I had done all of those progression of the drunk driving deal because I got drunk and wrecked everything I ever put a key in. It was dreadful. That probably was why the men in my life had to leave me. They couldn't pay the repair bills on the car. So they just turned me over to their mechanics, I don't know. So I kept moving on. And finally, my drinking had gotten so bad. This marriage dissolved, but I still had the daughter for a while. And then I had wrecked so many cars and done so many crazy things. I think he really thought I'd put her in the car and kill her. And so he took her with him, and I would have to get somebody taken there to see her. That didn't heal me up at all. I just figured he was a bad guy and he meant more money than I did to spend on lawyers. And it wasn't about the drinking, it was just about people just didn't understand me. You know, if people had made an effort to understand me, all those guys, things would have been fun. It was those guys, it wasn't me. And sooner or later I'd find a guy who understood me. I knew that. Because that's the way it is, right? That's what they tell you when you're a little kid. Sooner or later you'll find a guy and he'll understand. And so I kept looking and drinking and rolling right on along. Back before I was ever incarcerated in treatment, I was still drinking before I ever got the needles and that stuff. I was still drinking pretty hard and partying a lot. I was in San Diego, so we used to go to Mexico and party in the nightclubs down there. We'd come back and we'd party all night, make a lot of noise, disturb a lot of people. And I was having one of those parties, and I lived on the third floor of an apartment building. And you know, back in the 60s, you didn't have air conditioning, and that just wasn't the thing. And so all the windows were up. It's one of those old buildings you walk up, you know, really rickety old place. And I had the whole top floor. And mostly the people that were at this party would go up on the roof. And but I wasn't really functional enough to get up on the roof. So I was in my apartment, and all the windows were open, and it was hot. Because, you know, when you're drunk, it's hard to cool down. And so I climbed into the window, and I had my legs hanging out, and was just sort of, you know, trying to breathe in and out. It's hard to breathe when you're drunk. And somebody called the police, and they thought that I was, I don't know, maybe trying to do myself in. Whatever gave them that idea. And they came up there, and they were real ugly to me. And by this time I'm really loaded, but I'm not blacked out yet. I can remember this. And in San Diego, the police wore helmets like highway patrol. And it's just horrible. It's like the Gestapo. And they wanted to know what was going on, and I was having a little gathering here. And they put handcuffs on me and took me to a psychiatric unit. And they kept me there in restraints for a while. And I didn't understand what the deal was. It didn't make the slightest sense to me that they would come into my home where I paid the rent and bother me and interfere with what I was doing. I didn't know that I was bothering anybody else. The neighbors never told me that I was bothering them. They were always at the party. So it didn't register that what I was doing, the way I was living, was aberrant. They kept me there in a psych unit maybe 3 days, and that was where I found out about Librium. And they give you a lot of that because when you rape a lot of cane and kick up a lot of sand in those hospitals, they don't want to deal with you. So they do anything they can do to calm you down. And Librium was okay. It's not as good as drinking because you can dance when you drink. I love to dance. You can't dance on Librium, trust me. You can't dance in restraints either. So I stayed there for however long that little visit went, and then I got out and went on my way to whatever else I was supposed to be doing. And moved along. That was, I went backwards, didn't I? Okay, I'm past the first three the first floor. And, gee, am I supposed to tell this from up here?
I've never heard it.
Okay. So anyway, I found that maybe the drinking was a problem. I didn't think it was responsible for the demise of my life, but I thought that maybe if I didn't drink quite so much, quite so often, things might come together a little better for me. I didn't lose my jobs to drinking. I didn't go back to a lot of jobs because I was hungover or drunk. But nobody ever fired me. I didn't stay long enough to get fired. You know, that's interesting. I worked always. My whole drunk career, I always worked. I had a resume. You know, I couldn't call on anything for a career. But I always worked, and when people didn't ask to sue me, I went out the back door. So if I didn't get fired, I didn't think that I lost jobs to drinking. When I got here, that was real important to me when people talked about losing their jobs to drinking. Well, I didn't do that. That wasn't part of who I was. You guys did that. I didn't do that. But I never was able to stay anywhere, ever. I decided that I would find whoever was next, and maybe he could stop me from drinking if I found someone who didn't drink like I did. So that's what I did. Went out and I found the biggest, meanest, ugliest man I could find, and he didn't drink, and I married him. And he was a truck driver, and I liked to drive, so that's what we did. We went off on the road, and I couldn't drink. And that lasted about an hour and a half, and I was just insane. I had a drink. Well, he slowed me down. He put it in areas where I had to scratch to drink. I had to sneak to drink. And so I wasn't drinking every day. I wasn't drinking as much or as often. But I'd find ways to get off the truck for a few days and stay home. I'd find ways to sneak off when we'd be shut down somewhere in a motel. Whatever I could do, I would do. And this man, like I said, he was pretty mean. And he would hammer on me, and you know, try to stop me. He tried. He did. I thought he could quit me from drinking, and he tried to, and he almost beat me to death. He just almost finished me off. It went on for several years, and I wrecked several vehicles with him. I was arrested in several states for drunk driving, and finally, the licensing situation was getting real tough because by now there's computer hookups all around, and so even though you keep changing your name and doing this and doing that, it's getting harder and harder to replace driver's licenses. So it reached a point where I couldn't drive a truck anymore, and that suited me just fine because then he had to leave me at home, and I could get drunk while he had to make a living, so I could get drunk while he was out working. And when he would come home, then the violence would start. And there again, you know, if he wasn't such a bad guy, we wouldn't have all those fines. And I would hide the booze, and I would struggle around, and he would find it, or he would see me drunk. It was no big secret when I was stumbling around, falling on my head. I wrecked a car one weekend going to the daycare center. This man and I had a son. And the little boy was maybe a year and a half old, and I was going to pick him up from the daycare center, and I was ripped. And I hit a pole on my way over there, and I had a big car, it was an Oldsmobile or something, and I took out the whole passenger side of the car. The infant seat was there, the whole side was gone, and I really can't say whether the people at the daycare center would have given my son to me in the condition I was in or not, but if they had, he wouldn't be here. He would no longer be with us. And I didn't learn a thing. I did not grasp that this was God talking to me. I learned nothing. I drank a while longer, and my husband came in off the road, and I was extremely drunk, and there was a real violent exchange, and he seriously assaulted me, and left, and came back, and I think he thought I would bleed to death, and he took me to the hospital. And I know that wasn't out of any in-depth feeling. It was to stay out of jail because he thought I would bleed to death. And he took me in there, and he left me in the emergency room, and he told them that I had gotten into a bar fight, and that was how I got in the condition I was in. That's important that I share that, because for new people, for anybody who's just trying to sober up, you know, I was a victim in that case. I was a sincere victim. I almost died, but because I was drunk and he was sober, I had no credibility. And the people in that hospital did not believe me. They believed him. And he got in his vehicle and he left there. And I was there for several days before anybody bought my story at all. And eventually they were reported. Not a big deal. But the reality was that that wouldn't have happened to me if I had not been drunk. It would not have. I wouldn't have been with that person if I hadn't been drunk. So it really alters people's perception of us, even when we're right, even when we are the injured party. The drinking puts us in the wrong. And I got out of there. I didn't learn anything. I went out and drank again. I had other people's blood in my veins. I had staples still in me. I was held together with baling wire. And I went out and drank some more. And it continued a few months more. And finally, now I'm in North Little Rock, in Arkansas. And I went out, I think he was home for the weekend or something. And I snuck out and I got drunk. And I drove my automobile off a cliff, and it was a big car, a big heavy car, and it's probably the only thing that kept me alive. I drove down the bank of the Arkansas River, and the Arkansas River is a transit river. It's they float barges down it, so it's really, really deep, straight from the bank, maybe 35 or 40 feet deep, straight down. My old car caught on a tree trunk or something on the frame, and it didn't go into the river. But it was one of those big old fancy cars, and it had electric door locks and electric windows and electric abilities to get out of it. And I couldn't get out because I was trapped in there and the car was gone. And when I recovered enough, when I came to see where I was terrified. Now I'm scared, okay? I've almost killed my child. I've almost been beaten to death. Didn't scare me. Now I'm scared. I think I'm going to drown. So I'm sitting in this car and I'm looking straight down in this water, and I don't know if I'm going to get out of here alive or not. And it was one of those brief instances of clarity that God gives us to maybe shake me just a little bit, wake me up just a little bit, and it took. I wasn't sure if I'd get up that bank alive, but I made a deal, a real deal with God. If I got up the bank alive, I wouldn't drink anymore. But I didn't know how to do that. So I didn't drink anymore. That was December 13th, 1985. And when they got me out of the hospital and patched me up, they put me in jail for that one. And I was in jail a little while, and then I got out. And I did not ever drink again. But without AA, not drinking is worse than drinking. It is horrible. I would be out away from my home, and if I had any money in my purse, I would go in the drugstore or Walmart or somewhere and spend it real fast to see if I was going to drink. I finally decided maybe God would find me in church. So I went to church, and I prayed, and I wept, and I carried on. And I lasted almost 5 years in the church. I almost wore out the carpet at the altar. I prayed every prayer. I begged God to heal me of this compulsion to drink. And still, I didn't understand. I still didn't get it. And I didn't remember, way out on the West Coast, when I was maybe 18 years old, one of my little jail visits, I had been to an AA meeting. The reason I went to the AA meeting was because you got out of the cell and went somewhere else. And a nice lady gave me a half a cup of coffee and told me to sit down. And I didn't understand the implication of the half a cup at that time, but I do today. I didn't hear a thing. A few years later, among the drunk driving arrests out on the West Coast again. I was court ordered to AA for 90 meetings. And I did that, and I went. And out there in Venice and West Los Angeles, and I made 90 meetings. I didn't hear anything, and I didn't grasp anything that I was aware of. And so, here I am all these many years later, crawling around in the church trying to not die from the compulsion to drink, trying to not get drunk, trying to keep this promise to God. Well, my husband got out of jail and moved us to Florida, and so I had fun with the church. I came to Florida, and I didn't like it here, and I didn't want to be here, and I didn't know a soul, and I started going to church, taking my little boy. By now, my little boy is pretty big, and he's violent. I mean, this is what he's learned. This is what he's watched in his life. So he does what he's seen us do. And he was real tough to handle. He was one of those little kids that would square off with you like a man, just punch you. And I took him to the minister for counseling. And that went on for, you know, a few weeks. And finally, the minister wanted to talk to me. And he asked me if I had ever tried AA, and I was really offended. And I said, well, I don't drink. And he said, he asked me a lot of questions, and he said, well, I think you ought to try AA. I don't think the problem here is the kid. And he shared some of his own experience with me. And he had found recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous before he went to seminary, and he knew exactly what was wrong. But by now I am just without any resources at all. The husband went to federal prison then. I didn't mention he's a career criminal besides a truck driver, so he went to jail a lot. And at that point he went to federal prison and left us without resources. We didn't have anything to take care of ourselves. I didn't know anything and I was scared. Didn't know how to take care of myself. Just got to remember now, I've had somebody, one of them guys, doing it for me all this time. So I didn't know how to really take care of myself or my child. So I thought, well, this minister's giving me some advice. I'll just do it. Nobody really wanted me anywhere. My mother didn't want me at her breakfast table. I had no friends left. Nobody could stand me, and I really couldn't stand myself. Being alone with me was a nightmare. And it was just awful. The insanity of this disease, when it takes off and we don't have anything to anesthetize ourselves, it's just dreadful. So I tried AA, and I came in over there in Lakeland at on the west side, and I didn't understand, I didn't hear. I was going to meetings maybe 90, 100 days before I realized that how it worked said the same thing every time they read it. I was in real trouble, and they kept telling me to keep coming back and hugging me and being nice to me, and I thought, this is better than any place else, because nobody had been nice to me or want me back in a long, long time. And I went a lot, because the only time I wasn't in pain was when I was in an AA meeting. If I could sit in a meeting, I was okay. Usually somebody would come and take me. I went 3 or 4 times a day. I'd go to any kind of meeting. I didn't care. I'd get up and I'd be ready to go to AA. And when somebody would come, we'd go. Wherever it was, or whether it was smoking or non-smoking or book study or speaker, or, it didn't matter. If it was AA and they told me to come back, I came. And everybody was very nice to me. And they told me to not drink and go to meetings and read the big book. Well, I was not one of those people that could do all three of those things. I could not drink and I could go to meetings, but I had to listen to you all tell me what the big book said, because I could not read 2 sentences and remember what the first one said. I couldn't comprehend anything. I couldn't put anything together. My mind was gone. I was scrambled. I was just really, really scattered. My son went into the custody of HRS, the minister that helped me so much, indicated that the violence in our home had to cease. And so HRS took him, and at that time we had another ladies' recovery house over there, and I went to live there for a while, and I met a lot of people that I probably otherwise would not have met. I met my sponsor, I met a whole generation of women that just took me in. At that point, I cried all the time. I was the worst, saddest, most pitiful excuse for a human being you've ever seen. I was all buttoned up, and Mary Shaw said that I was 3 inches shorter and none of my limbs worked correctly, and that's probably true. I was a real mess, but they put up with me. They would come and get me, and they would take me to meetings. They would take me to wherever they were going, to whatever was going on, people's houses, didn't matter. And they would include me. And I could not understand what they all found so damn funny about being a drunk. You know, it's like I was so humiliated. By now, you know, I've been in church a while, so I've cleaned up my behavior a little bit, and I was just horribly humiliated to be connected with that stuff. I didn't want to talk about that stuff, and they talked about it openly, like, you know, like it was okay to say this out loud. And I didn't get it. I didn't get anything. But I kept going. And my sponsor told me, she said, it doesn't matter if you believe it, you say it. It doesn't matter if you want to go, you get in the car. It doesn't matter if you like it, do it. Well, I like that because I needed a little guidance. I didn't like people giving me direction. Oh, God, they would say to me, you've got to learn to take a little direction. And I hated that word. I didn't have any direction when I got here. I didn't have any. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't really know where I'd been. I didn't know what I was doing. Could not make a decision. I would drive into the parking lot of the beauty shop and couldn't get a haircut. It was terrible. I couldn't do anything. I had a job frying chicken, which I hated, but they would hide me in the back with a pressure pot and chicken, and I could cry, and that was okay, so I could keep a job. So I kept going back to this job. And that was what they told me. They said, you got to keep going. Mary used to tell me, she said, you got to keep going. You got to stay there until you could leave. Now, what does that mean? You've got to stay till you can leave? I don't understand that. But I kept going. I had, when I left that job, with my head high, more longevity in that particular job than I had had in my entire life. And I was 40-odd years old at that time. And, but I did stay. And I left to a career. I did not leave out the back door. With a notice, they told me a lot of interesting things that made no sense whatsoever. I would go over to her house and I would sit there and I want to talk about me. I want to talk about what's wrong with me. And they don't talk about all this stuff. They talk about everything else. And I'd think, well, when are we going to talk about me? When are we going to talk about my stuff? And it'd be 3 o'clock in the morning, it's time to go to bed. And we never talked about me. And they kept telling me, just keep coming and you'll get better. And I kept coming and I really did get better. And I don't know why. I really don't know why. After a while, I started to comprehend what the big book said. And I started to understand that the steps are not on the wall. And if the steps are worked off the wall, then all I'll have is off the wall recovery. So I had to apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to my daily life. I don't believe that we come in and we work the steps and now we're done and move on to graduate school. I believe that the steps are a constant daily application to my life. And in order to live and breathe and walk upright and have all my limbs work correctly, I have to apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life on a daily basis. I had no problem admitting that I was powerless over alcohol. And let's face it, my life was unmanageable. But now, a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Well, see, I've been on my knees a long time, almost 5 years, and whatever power was out there had not restored me to anything. So I had to find a power outside myself that I could comprehend. And you all helped me with that. It was the God of my understanding, not that old vindictive, frightening God of my childhood, but a God that I could communicate with and a God that I could truly understand and apply to my life. And then I got comfortable with that. Once I believed that, then I could turn my life over to Him. And I have to do that every day. I didn't back there when I was clearing up, turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and then move on. I get up every morning and turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And I ask for guidance and I ask for help to not drink today and be of service in some way. And that's worked real well for me as I've moved along. I don't believe that we stop in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that either we go forward or we go backwards. And backwards is back out the door, and there is nothing out there for me. When I came to my fourth step, I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. In the first place, who on earth would write that stuff down where somebody else might see it, for God's sake? And then they wanted you to, like, make these columns and do this stuff. And well, what if somebody saw it? And they knew how illiterate I was, because I quit school in the ninth grade, but I really didn't learn anything past about the seventh grade. And I was a moron, and I knew it, and you all would know it if I wrote this stuff down. And I didn't want to do it. I put it off, and I put it off. And finally, a gentleman in my home group looked at me one night, and he said, "Well, how long do you want to be sick?" "Well, I want to be sick. I want to get better." I wanted them to think I wanted to get better anyway. I thought, God, if they think I don't want to get better, then let me stay. And where would I go? So I did it. I said, and then I did it. And then I had to share pieces of myself with another human being. And my understanding of the fifth step is not a confessional. My understanding of the fifth step is that I seek another person, a human person that I can touch, and the God of my understanding works through human persons that I can touch. His hands are the hands that you reach out to me. His words are the words that you say to me. So I just had to connect with one of God's people and share pieces of me out loud. Because when it's inside my head, it's technicolor, and it works, and it's rational. And when I say it out loud to you, then it takes form and it takes shape. And then I know whether it makes sense or not. And then I can get a little feedback from somebody who's been doing this, walking down this same road a while, been through some of this stuff, and healed up, and isn't quite so raw as I am. And maybe they can help me, because the fifth step is about discovering the patterns of my living that have created all this difficulty with staying alive, all this stuff that I kept doing to cover up my inability to cope with reality. So it wasn't all that bad. And one of my defects of character, if you have not ascertained this by now, was running. I ran from everything. I did not face anything. I ran from jobs, men, children, parents, school. It made no difference. If it was there and I had to be confronted with anything, it was so threatening and so frightening that I ran out the back door. I thought that my last husband was the reason I was a gypsy. I've been married to him for 15 years, and since he was a career criminal and a truck driver, of course, he dragged me all over the earth, and I thought that I wouldn't live like that. I wouldn't have led a nomadic life if it hadn't been that guy. Well, when we sat down and talked about this particular defect, we discovered that I had moved 86 times in my memory, and I lived in the same house till I was 13, and I didn't move 86 times with that husband. So these were Brenda's defects of character. She went out and found somebody that would play into her defects, and we waltzed off in our defects together. Well, that helped me a lot. It helped me to look at me. It helped me to take an honest look at who I was and who I'd been and who I hoped to be. And who I hoped to be was somebody that I patterned after the ladies that I met in AA. I wanted to learn to talk like a lady. I wanted to learn to walk like a lady and dress like a lady and behave like a lady. I would have really liked to have been able to drink like a lady, but you can't have everything. I got some of that stuff. I have a sponsor, some of you know her, who is very sweet and very soft, and she says to me things like, "Brenda, why don't you wear that nice gray outfit with that pretty little bow in your hair when you go to speak?" But what she's really saying to me is what she said all those years ago: "Don't you show up over there with that hair stringing down your back and in hot pants and embarrass me." And that's what she means. And see, I had to have people tell me that bluntly. I had to have them look me right in the face and say, that's inappropriate, Linda. You can't talk like that. You can't do that. That is not what ladies do. That is not what you're supposed to do. And there were a lot of those things. But I didn't know. I just didn't know. So I had to get better. I had to get wounded. You know, when I got here, I was so thin-skinned that I thought I'd bleed to death through my flesh. It was awful. And you couldn't say anything to me without weeping. Mary Charlotte, when you talked to me, she was afraid I'd kill myself. You know, it had to be somebody tough to deal with me and my foolishness. So I moved on through that first step. And then I got to that little step, you know, that little one where we have to become entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character. I don't know anybody in AA that would have any trouble whatsoever with that step if it wasn't for entirely and all. But entirely, I mean, and all, and I'm an alcoholic and I don't understand absolute. So I had to get to a place where I believed that God could remove all my defects of character and I could be entirely ready for him to do that at his leisure. He could not just suddenly take them all away because I had to have something to fill in the gap. God doesn't just leave us empty. So a little at a time, I had to learn new behaviors to fill in for the old ones. And that's the way it's been. And I've still got some of those defects that didn't give me so much trouble a few years ago that today we're working on because now I'm ready. Now I'm entirely ready to have these defects of character removed. And I'm working with them. Humbly ask him to remove them. That was not hard for me. Humility was not hard for me because I had always been so weak and so dependent. And so I really liked the idea of just humbly asking God to just take it. Just take it. Then we get to the next list. And I ran roughshod through a lot of people in my life. That list was real long for me. It remains long for me. I had to look at it in a fair way to myself. I couldn't just bulldoze into those things. So the ninth step is a progressive enterprise. I like that. I don't think that people who are an hour and a half sober should sit down and make a list of all the people they have harmed and run out and make amends to them. Generally, we make amends to the wrong people. We make amends to people we don't owe amends to, and we don't make amends to the people we do. Ninth step requires some help from somebody who's been doing this thing a while, some guidance. Some of us have legal implications and severe moral implications. Some of us have career implications. A lot of things that have to be handled carefully. I don't believe that except where it would wound them or others means that I'm an other. I absolutely disagree with anybody who says that because it is a cop-out. It is I just don't want to do it. And I don't buy that. But I also don't think that we should do it haphazardly without guidance. Everything that I do, I talk over with other people. I heard a lady speak the other night, and she said what is in my heart. I have a sponsor who knows everything that there is to know about me, everything that I have done, everything that I hope to do, everything that I'm about, what I'm trying to do, how I feel. I have a core group of ladies that know almost everything about me. So if I can't get to my sponsor or God takes her to the next level, I still have somebody that I don't have to bring up to speed on what's going on with me. If I'm in trouble, they're going to know it. And then I have a whole bunch of folks smattered out in the fellowship that know just enough about me to hold my hand and walk me through and help me stay alive. And that is how I stay alive in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hold hands with other alcoholics. I trust my sponsor. I trust her completely. I trust the ladies in my life. I trust Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that getting on the telephone and calling somebody is an act of faith. It is a willingness, and willingness is the cornerstone of what happens for me. It doesn't matter who picks up the phone. If I get 13 answering machines, and I get you, and you gave me your phone number tonight, and I never talked to you before, what you say to me will be what I need to hear. Because it isn't about me, and it isn't about you. It's about what God puts in our conversation. When I go to an AA meeting, what I hear people share is not the same thing that Joy hears them share. It's not the same thing that Mary hears them share. I hear what I went there needing to hear. So do they. If we come with an open mind and a willing heart, God fills in the gap. The God, in my understanding, does that in this program. I believe that AA is a God-given program, and I don't believe anything out there can wreck it. The 10th step is a constant house cleaning, and I think that people who do not do that inventory with their day rob themselves of some real peaceful sleep. Taking an inventory of what I've done, and it doesn't mean the wrong I've done, it means who have I been today? Am I who I say I am? Am I doing what I expect myself to do? You know, expectations are not all negative. Expectations are important. My sponsor tells me all the time, if I never expected you to grow up, you wouldn't have started. And that's the truth. We have to expect good out of each other instead of that old stuff. Everybody always used to expect me to show my rump. That's what they did. If Brenda's coming, it's going to be chaos. Well, that isn't the case now. They expect me to show up like a lady, and that's what I try to do. I inventory who I have maybe harmed, who I've helped. How good do I feel about what I did? How can I do it better next time? I do it in my job. I do it in my personal life. I certainly do it in my acts of service. I constantly try to improve my relationship with my higher power. Spirituality for me is not esoteric. You know, everybody's got their own deal, and I don't come down on anybody else's. But these folks that tell me that God talks to them, this don't work for me. The God of my understanding don't burn bushes and part things today. He talks to me through you. And if I don't come where you are, if I don't pick up the phone, if I don't listen to you when you're talking, if I don't get with you and give you a chance to talk. You know, in the old days, I didn't know people took turns talking. I just thought everybody just jumped in and just ran their mouth all the time. The deal is, I've got to turn, and you've got to turn. And if we all get said what we need to get said, then God's done his job there. We don't let God do his job when we get in his way. So I pray, I listen, I go where it flows. I go to a lot of AA meetings. My spiritual connection with my higher power is not in the headboard, it's not in the fax machine, it's not on the telephone with him, it's on the telephone with you. And if I don't leave myself open to you, I'm not going to hear what he says. I believe that 12-step work is everything we do. I believe sitting in meetings and sharing is 12-step work. I believe emptying ashtrays is 12-step work. I go to these offices, I go to treatment centers. I work with people that will talk with me. I drive people that will get in my car. I listen if people want to talk to me. I talk to the people that call me. I do what is before me and don't debate it. I don't get to decide what I do. I don't get to sit down and have an agenda. These are the things I'd like to do and who I'd like to be known as. That's garbage. God decides what I do. And other than my daily work, which God has provided me with a nice career and a good living, and I do what they tell me to do over there, and that's great. But I do what I am supposed to do that comes to me. When I'm called, I go. When I'm asked, I try to rise to the occasion. And I believe that is what I'm saying. I don't think that everybody hauls drunks around in the back seat anymore because we have treatment centers now. And so I had a real affinity with a gentleman that I think Charlie knew, Don Golden, that used to say, don't take yourself seriously. You're not really doing 12-step work, so you get a little puke on your shoe. And that's true. But Unfortunately, most of us don't clean up that way anymore. We don't sit at the kitchen table and sober people up now. They go to detox. They go to treatment facilities. But if you need to go to detox, call me. Now, if you're drunk and you need to talk about it, and you're already drunk, and you don't want to go to detox, call somebody else. Because I cannot help you once you've drank, unless you want to go somewhere and sober up, and I'll be happy to drive over and get you. I think we do each other a disservice when we pander to one another's weaknesses. I know that when my weaknesses were pandered to, I got weaker. And when I was expected to straighten up and get stronger, I did. My life has improved. I have a life. I've had no life before. I went from chaos to chaos to crisis. Today, I am a professional person. I work with law enforcement. I don't get handcuffs on these anymore. I carry a key in my pocket for the handcuffs on my belt. I go to work every day. I do what I'm supposed to do. And I'm respected in the area that I work, in the area that I live, in the area that I socialize. My children are not beaten on me anymore, so they've learned that that's not the appropriate behavior. There are a lot of things that are vastly different for me, and they did not change overnight. I had to do some footwork. This is not something, Mike McConnell says it, if you think that sitting at the table in AA will make you recovered, go home and put a chair in your garage and see how long it takes you to be a car. We have some action that we must take. There are some things that we must do, and if we do not apply the principles and the steps to our lives, we will be sitting unrecovered around AA. And I don't want to be an aroundie. I was an aroundie in my former life. Today I am integrated into a life that is happy, joyous, and free, and it's exciting to be in AA. It's a real pleasure. The people that I meet here are real people. The friendships that I have here are real friendships. You know, I changed people all the time in the old days. I just wrote you off. Today, I do not have to write anybody off. I have not had to give up a single person since I got sober. I have not lost anybody to my bad behavior. I've been corrected a lot. I've been guided back into better behavior. But I haven't had to throw anyone away.